Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to another episode of Voices for Excellence. I am your host, Dr. Michael Connor, CEO and founder of the Agile Evolutionary Group, and of course, the proud host of VFE. And it did not take me far to find this guest that I absolutely admire. He is in the great state of Virginia. I call him one of the legacy superintendents because when I was a chief academic officer, assistant superintendent, I would always reach out to Dr. Greg Hutchins, and he has always been there for me. It doesn't matter I was a CAO, doesn't matter when I was a superintendent, my transition into my own corporation. Dr. Gregory C. Hutchinson Jr., my alpha brother, as we say. Right. Has just been an absolute partner of mine. And there is not anything anybody can say to me about Dr. Greg Hutchinson Jr. Doc has been a superintendent, but most famously for, right? We always talk about Remember the Titans, right? And trust me, his work is beyond that. But everybody's like, oh, where was Doc from? I was like, you ever seen that movie with Denzel Washington? With TC High School in Alexandria, Virginia. They were like, oh yeah. I was like, that's where Doc was. And then they kept back and they're like, oh, really? But of course, yeah, superintendent of the year. Now he has his own company, Revolutionary Ed LLC. It is just an absolute honor to have one of the best in America, specifically when we talk about some of the polarized topics in education. The three letters I say that just brings this level of political inertia into education, DEI. We are going to unwrap that in totality with the national, international expert, Dr. Gregory C. Hutchinson Jr. Doc, how are you? Yes. Welcome to VFE, my brother.
Yes, happy to be here. And, you know, as you were talking about DEI, I always say when I'm talking, I add A to it. So diversity, equity, inclusion, and anti-racism.
I can tell this episode.
You know, everybody else wants to say belonging. I'm like, okay, come on. You can belong to something, but let's talk about that anti-racism piece.
Absolutely, Doc. I admire the work you've been doing, man, across the country. Now that you're bringing that DEIA, anti-racism approach, that's even going deeper into the core threads of the genetics of specific organizational cultures, teaching and learning, classroom pedagogy. Your impact is just leaving a legacy, and I want to personally thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate this opportunity, too. I'm proud of you. Like, keep up the great work. I'm just honored to be here. You know, I feel like we just sitting on the couch talking.
This is the rationale to why we have this podcast, because, again, I try to bring on the high intellects within the actual ecosystem. And the conversations that I have just across the country, across the disciplines within the ecosystem, I'm like, we got to bring this to a level of professional learning, asynchronous professional learning for leaders and practitioners out there. Because, I mean, how many people would love just to have a one-hour discussion with you, Doc? A lot of people would. And if I'm lucky to create this platform to have you on for 1 hour, I want the whole world to unpack your strategies and learn your methodologies that you're applying. But I can't forget. You are at Howard University as a professor as well. So we're going to talk about that, Doc. But again,
you know.
Right. The Black Ivy, right? Black Ivy, man. And I tell you, you know, you're doing some marvelous, marvelous things. But again, you and I, we can sit down like we're pretending we're sitting on the couch, have this conversation. But let's get into what you are thinking, what your strategies and approaches are within the ecosystem around this DEIA work that you're presenting, but level setting of how we could continue to build shared mental models around this important work. But before we even get into that, this is a fun question, and I can't wait to see what your response is, right? Because education stakeholders across the country, across the world who engage with you, right, who engage in Dr. Hutchinson's work with equity and excellence, What is your song that describes your leadership signature in the ecosystem?
You know what? It depends on the day. It depends
I
on the
got a
day.
guess. I got a
It depends
guess.
on the day. But you know, you probably
I got a
won't
guess.
guess this one. You won't guess one because I got a lot. But this one, the one I'm going to say, you might not guess because, you know, right now across this country, as you all know, like, I mean, there is like anti-DEIA, you know, mission out there, right? And it's a movement and it's real. So with my leadership and me going out to kind of like fight against these anti-Black and anti-DEIA kind of like extremists out there, the song that comes to mind for me is Raheem Devon, I Don't Care. So I don't care, right? The chorus line, I don't, they can hate if they want, I don't care, right? That is kind of what my leadership is right now because it's about going out here and being unapologetically and authentically myself and in my own leadership and speaking my own truth and my lived experience. So I don't care what folks out there say. You know,
I
we're gonna
love
keep it moving. So that's the kind of leadership I'm bringing through Revolutionary Ed. And that's the point in having a whole title, you know, of our business. You know, it's revolutionary. Like Revolutionary Ed, it came to mind with me when I was a principal in Nashville many years ago. So it was almost 20 years ago, which is crazy that I was a principal. But I was principal of the year in Nashville, and they did this article called The Revolutionary on they had my picture. I'm standing there like, you know, all big and tall, thinking I'm all that back then before, you know, I just started out. And when I was thinking of the name of my business, my wife was like, "Well, what about the revolutionary? Remember it?" And I was like, "Revolutionary Ed." And so she actually helped me come up with the idea. But I don't care, Raheem Devon. That is the song. I got
Joaquin.
long-winded. You know, I'll get long-winded, so I tell all kinds of stories.
Listen, let's do that. You got to get long-winded, but I love the association dot. I love it. Where the anti or the DEI A word and that association with I don't care, because you have to have this mindset, this revolutionary disruptive mindset where
That's right.
you know what is right for the kids, specifically now Generation Z, Generation Alpha. Within the next 2 years, 57% of education, whether it be public or charter, will be Black or Brown. So this
That's right.
work is inevitable. We have to be able to bring different dimensions of race and culture into the equation if we want to truly analyze the organizational profiles and various structures and systems that have historically been lamented in education. We have to be able to come with a
That's right.
critical analysis and interrogate that. But that approach of I don't care, they can hate all they want, because and I want to unpack this with you as we get further into the podcast. Why has it become so polarized? Why has this work become so politicized when all of the demographical data, all of the sociographical data, all of profile data is showing that our schools are becoming more diverse and bringing in a variety of different cultures? I want to get your expertise on that, but I don't care. That's my new, listen, my theme song I used to come into or love, I would say my equity song, an excellent song, is Super Bad by James Brown. But
Oh,
now,
shoot, all
with
right.
this work,
Super
man,
bad.
I love it. I don't care. And
I don't care.
we're going to have that attitude to continue to move the trajectory forward for our kids. But getting into that, and this nice little segue, right? Your work regarding diversity, equity, and inclusion, Doc, specifically on focused on dismantling systemic racism in education, as
That's
you
right.
outlined it, which is the A, have been adopted by many leaders and districts in the country. They seek you for this work. Now, the creation of your organization, as you was talking about, Revolutionary Ed LLC, I want you to expand on what is the mission and the vision of Revolutionary Ed, and how has this work been providing learning organizations the necessary tools and shift in
That's right.
mindset so that this work is systematized in all of our classrooms throughout America?
Well, one, let me just tell you that, Revolutionary Ed, as I said, I was so empowered for myself to get into this space because, a superintendent of Alexandria City Public Schools, I was in the state of Virginia, right? You say the great state, but right now with Governor Youngkin as the at the helm, I don't know how great of a state it is, but I will say this. When he was in place and he was trying to dismantle any DEI efforts in the state of Virginia, that was when I knew I was going to need to go bigger and beyond Alexandria. And that's when I first had the whole inkling to even want to like expand my reach, right? A lot of people think that I got out of the superintendency because I was tired. I mean, I'm always tired. So I didn't get out of the superintendency because I was tired. I got out of superintendency to do more work, right? And that's what Revolutionary Ed is all about. So our mission is around empowering school systems to truly have transformational change that is sustainable, right? And this is through refining and sometimes completely uprooting their curricular efforts in a community so that Black and Brown children especially are being impacted in a positive way, right? And a part of our vision is that we will completely dismantle systemic racism in public education, right? And I mean that's a huge endeavor to have, but this is why I gotta have I don't care mentality to be able to get out there and keep getting back up every day, especially with what's happened across this nation. And just one thing that you said earlier, Mike, what you talked about was around the simple fact that people are kind of there's this movement and there's the DEI efforts and DEIA efforts have been polarized and politicized, right? And the reason for that is because we were on the cusp, or we are on the cusp of having, historical change. And I believe that many people in America, unfortunately, right now, they are afraid of what will happen if Black and Brown people become truly empowered. So this is why when you're afraid, what do? You're desperate. Right, you begin to use scare tactics, and a lot of these tactics are very similar to what happened during the civil rights movement, very similar to what happened during Reconstruction when we began to have Jim Crow laws. Right, so this is not a new playbook that folks are playing from. All they're doing is really repeating history. But the resistance right now is because we were about to have a historical shift, and folks are like, "Oh, no, we're not doing that." Right. And I think that's why this change is happening. That pushback is continuous. So we got to push and persevere, in spite of what's happening. So that's how I
Absolutely.
feel about that.
No, great, great, great sentiments, Doc, because I'm taking copious notes here with all of the essential themes, meta and mega themes that you're highlighting. But one thing that resonated with me, especially through your organization, Revolutionary Ed, is that you're not afraid to help districts have this level of serial disruption, radicalization of the legacy systems that they've been implementing and employing, i.e., as you stated, uprooting the curriculum and then a culture, a dynamic cultural shift that Revolutionary Ed is working on, dismantling racism in education. Before I underpin with regards to the rationale with the historical change and historical shifts, when we think about dismantling racism in education, and I go back to the famous quote of W.E. Deming, every system's outputs, or the system is perfectly designed for the outputs that it gets.
That's
We
right.
know historically how the education model has been designed, rooted, and articulated, right? From
So
the
true.
Agrarian, from the agrarian paradigm to now the industrial paradigm. Now we have to look at this in a new paradigm, right? The Agrarian paradigm, I should state. But bringing that back to that dismantling racism in public education, unpack that for me because that is going to be a huge endeavor, specifically when we're examining specific threads of organizational culture. As a former superintendent, that culture is the hardest thing to change. Now, when we get into these interdependent threads of eliminating racism, microaggressions, implicit biases, we're talking about the totality of that. How do we unpack that, and where do we start, Doc?
First off, let me just tell you this, and I heard this. I was attending a conference last week, and I was on a I was in the audience of a panel, and Dr. Goldie Muhammad, she was on the panel, and she was talking about, which I totally agree with. She was talking about the simple fact that our curriculum and the way we run schools right now has not changed since the beginning of schools,
Correct.
right? So, you know, this structure was not intended for black and brown children in the first place, right? Because we were slaves at that time. And those structures and those practices, they might have been refined based on the era that we're in, but the core of the practice continues to remain the same, right? And you know, and when we dismantle that, well, part of dismantling that is literally taking on a whole new way to do our curriculum. And that leads to like culturally relevant pedagogy and culturally relevant teaching, you know, us making sure that our policies and our that really drives our practice, that these policies are put in place with black and brown children in mind, right? And I think that's something that we have not been courageous enough to do. Another thing I was just talking about recently was the simple fact that, you know, everyone's talking about the shortage that we have of black teachers in America. And, you know, one thing that I have said is that, yes, there is a shortage. However, the black teachers who graduate from like Howard University, because we produce some amazing black educators, right? The question is, do they want to work for you, right? Do you have an environment that is welcoming? Is it relevant? Is it representation, representative of them? You know, and that is the big question. Do black people want to work for you and for your school system, right? And that's a question that I'm really pushing to many organizations out there that are saying they can't find black teachers. And the simple fact that we don't have, or that we have this shortage of black educators across America, if you look at history, it all derived from when we had Brown v. Board of Education and we began to integrate schools. So Brown v. Board of Education anniversary, 70th anniversary is coming up, May 17th, right? So May 17th, 1954. When we had Brown v. Board of Education and we began to integrate our schools over the 20 years it took, right, for us to integrate schools because there was, with all deliberate speed, so there was a lot of resistance. 30,000 plus black educators lost their jobs. And they lost their jobs because these, once we became integrated, white schools said, we're not going to hire you as a black teacher or as a black principal, you know. So we were, in a sense, forced out of education. Hence, now we see that we have this struggle in numbers, right? It was already designed from America to get us out once we integrated these schools. So this is a national crisis that is due to are, you know, us being not only oppressed, but also the simple fact that we were being banned from working in these integrated schools. And that's what pushed us out of education. So I just wanted to, you know, to put that plug in there as well to give some context to why we're in this state now.
Compelling, compelling, Doc. You're absolutely right. You know, I've been keynoting and speaking across the country, and one thing I've been highlighting is have we truly demonstrated progress as we're approaching the 70th anniversary of Brown v. Board of Education? And really loved how you gave that context. It brings back some challenging research, Doc, and I'm going to bring this up. John Ogbu, we already know the contention John Ogbu's work presented years ago, but when I revisit Ogbu's work around assimilation, fictive kinship, and all of those research elements that he highlighted, I'm seeing a direct correlation now. I know that's not popular, but when you think about what Ogbu contended in his legacy research, you're like, wow, you're seeing some of the elements in a practical manner being played out now that we're seeing. Black teachers, I love how you contextualize that Basically, do they want to work for you? We see these plans being developed. We see these policies around the hiring or the retention of Black and Brown leaders, specifically Black leaders and teachers. But are the cultural norms conducive for them, and does it support them in a way for they're going to stay? So, absolutely, Doc. I loved how you unpacked that. Dismantling racism in public education. You don't care. You need to continue to boldly do that as well. But brother, I want to get in. And listen, Fred, I want to get into your book. All right. I want to get into your book.
Yep.
Right. I
Me
love
do
it. I
too.
read it.
I'm
To my
ready.
audience,
I'm
I
ready. I
read it.
do want to say this really quickly because John Ogbu did a lot of work with Shaker Heights, and I was superintendent of Shaker Heights City Schools and outside of Cleveland, Ohio. Some of his work, I didn't really agree with everything that John Ogbu had to
Correct,
say
correct.
when I came in. But one thing, and this is the thing, I felt like he was trying to make it as if some of his research, was saying like African Americans, we didn't like want to be successful and we didn't take the initiative and that whole pick yourself up by the bootstraps. When you don't have any straps to pick up, like Martin Luther King said, so where do you go with that, right? And it's going to be important for us, even when folks have the intelligence, the drive, there are systems that are intentional in place, whether it's schools or our economy or in our communities or in businesses, that prevents Black people from getting what they truly deserve, right? And then once you make it to a certain level, then folks will come in and try to get you out. Look at Dr. Gay, at the Harvard president, right? I
Right,
mean, she was in less than a year, got her out, right? You know what I'm saying? Like, and my thing is, and this continuously happens to us, and I think it's happening right now in the spotlight because people are trying to use these threats and scare tactics to say, if you are bold enough to be in these positions, no, we can get you out overnight, right? So it's scare tactics, which we need to stop being afraid. Let's be unafraid, and I don't care, right? It goes back to Malraveen Devon, but let's talk about the book. I just wanted to get that piece in there because you
Oh
brought up
no.
John Ogbu.
We could talk about Ogbu, man. I could tell you when I was finishing my dissertation a while ago and completed that in my lit review, I was vigorously arguing against John Ogbu's work, and I used another legacy research to to contradict that, which ultimately led to the program evaluation of culturally responsive pedagogy, which has been around for a while. This isn't
Yes,
new, Doc.
it's not new.
Everybody thinks it's a new educational fad, but it's been around historically for a while. We've had some really, really good scholars in that area, Gloria Lassen Billings, Geneva Gay, who has been talking about this historically, but now I think it's really being prevalent, it's being prioritized now. But the question that we have to continue is we know the theory, but what does this look like in practice, sustainable practice? And that continuation of not being afraid of the scare tactics to continue
That's
to
right.
change systems. But brother, getting into, listen, man, I read your book years ago, right? I had to pick it up again, and I started laughing because for me, it's like, wow, I see this evolution of my growth in this area, specifically how you unpacked it. It was done artfully and scientifically as well. And to my
That's
audience,
right.
if you do not have the book, please get Dr. Hutchinson's book. It's Getting Into Good Trouble at School: A Guide to Building an Anti-Racist School System. This book is
That's
a
right.
you got to get it. All right, tell yes, it's my fraternity brother, but you got to get the book because it challenges your intellectual capacity around what does this system look like where it's truly free of it's truly free of racism, and we can start really
That's
looking
right.
at all of our students with an equity lens. But I read it,
Yeah.
but to my audience who has not read your book, right, from a high level contextual overview, what are the key themes of the book, but
Yeah.
more importantly, how can it be used as a guide for leaders and teachers to start this arduous process of transforming
Right.
culture
Well,
and
first off,
mindset?
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Hey, go ahead, brother. Go ahead. Go ahead.
So I was just saying, I want to give a huge shout out to my co-author of the book, Doug Reed. He's a professor at Georgetown University. White male, right? White guy, black guy, two different walks of life. This is why the book is powerful, because it's given different perspectives, right? And we even went on a journey as we were writing the book, Doug and I. You know, sometimes he would write things, and I was like, "Did I write that?" He was like, "No, I wrote it." And I was like, "Well, you sound like a black man, right?" this portion, shoot, like we've been talking too much. Like, you know, you
Right,
write
right.
like me. You know, I loved it though, because we learned a lot about each other, and we were he was, you know, Doug is so bold and kind of like understanding his white privilege. And I really love that about him, and how we can use his white privilege to an advantage to help dismantle systemic racism by acknowledging it, number one, and then also by not using it in negative ways, but in ways to help others. So I wanted to first put that plug out there for Doug.
Yes.
But the book is, it's a guidebook, right? And it was intentionally written so that educators or parents or board members would be able to kind of understand the six pillars of becoming anti-racist. Number one, making sure that you know your history, right? So many folks, they start at trying to come to solutions without going to understand the history. Your history gives you a lot of information, right? It tells you why you are where you are. And every school system has some form of history, right? And a lot of folks don't even understand it. But I tell you, when you begin to research your history, you will see why special education classes, when they started, why they started, talented and gifted classes, when they started, why they started, most likely in the late 60s, early 70s, when schools were integrating to separate kids. And you're going to find that pretty much in every city across the nation, right? But it's going to give you some context to some of the challenges that you're faced with. Number two is committing to racial equity, right? A lot of folks, you know, they talk about equity, but racial equity is just as important. When you're looking at those racial disparities in your school systems, you're going to see that folks are, you know, black and brown students, there's a huge gap, you know, whether it's academics, whether it is, discipline, whether it is their success after school or whatever they attain after school, you're going to always find, you know, those disparities, which are very important. Number three is de facto segregation, right? And we are seeing that in schools across this nation, where students are put into either a gifted program, or there's pullout for honors programs, or there's a space for special ed, or there's a space for English learners. And all you're doing is creating a de facto segregated school environment. And
Absolutely.
it's happening time and time again, in our schools across America. Number four is dismantling that school to prison pipeline, right? It
Absolutely.
is happening in our buildings, right? Where you see students who are being treated as if they are already criminals. So then, and that start in elementary school, right? And then middle school and high school. So you're preparing them for the prison system, right? It's crazy that they're using formulas and they're looking at elementary numbers to determine how many prisons they build. Like, that's horrific. We should be ashamed of ourselves thinking that whoever made up that formula, we actually use it to build prisons in America. That's crazy to me, right? But it's a real fact.
Absolutely.
Number five is all about strategic thinking and strategic planning. Right. And I think a lot of folks have strategic plans. Many don't. Some of them get strategic plans, they put them on their shelves. Right. We're all about having a strategic plan that you are strategically thinking your way through the plan process and making sure that it's done with fidelity, and that you have goals that are going to be sustainable even when you're no longer there. Right. So that strategic thinking and that strategic planning is important. And then number six, which is the final from the book, is about courageous and bold leadership. And you know, a lot of folks, they want to be in that seat, right, of any type of leadership role, you know, superintendent, principal, central office, teacher leader, you know, whatever, PTA president. You know, people want these leadership roles, but do you have the courage and the boldness to push back even when things get rough, right? That means you got to stand tall and keep persevering and fighting and advocating, even when the world is against you, right? Because right now everybody's anti-DEIA, right? So you still got to sit at that platform and keep pushing through. So it is going to take that courageous and bold leadership. So in a nutshell, that is what our book is all about. I hope you all go out and get it, because it definitely is a guide to help you dismantle that systemic racism in your organization.
Meticulously crafted. Going back to my initial statement prior to this question, where the book content and design is just artistically and scientifically interfaced masterfully. Specifically, I love the whole process of the six pillars. One that resonates with me, obviously, when we look at the 70th anniversary of Brown v. Board of Education, one of your core pillars is eliminating these de facto segregated learning environments.
That's
So
right.
it kind of it there's that causality, not that correlation, but that causality between 70 years Brown v. Board of Education and what we still see are elements, rudiments, and even macro systems of segregation within our schools.
That's right.
Amazingly put it with the other five pillars. Last two, strategic thinking and planning, we see an overabundance of these strategic operating plans that look nice, that have critical objectives and strategies with milestones and grain size, elements that can be measured to see if we're getting to that goal. But again, what does it look like realized? What does it look like in practice with this level of fidelity and the thinking that's associated with it? But courageous and bold leadership now more than ever in the AC states
Now
of
more than
education.
ever.
We need that. But speaking on leadership, Doc, specifically executive leadership, and I want you to be bold and unapologetic when you answer this question.
No
Now,
problem.
we have seen, and please, I've been saving this question for you because I know you will bring the facts. I know you will bring the theory, the research, the data, and the implications based off of your analysis. So please be unapologetic with this because we are experiencing a mass exodus with current leaders. This is where I'm talking about. Now I'm getting down to the granularity, the specificity around Black leaders. National demographics, 1.8% of superintendents in America are Black women, and 1.9% are Black men. Now, what is your theory about, let's be honest, these metrics are dismal, right? What is your theory behind this? But what does hope and change mean if I'm an upcoming principal, Black principal, if I'm an upcoming African American woman who's an assistant superintendent to strive to be a superintendent? What does that mean to be a Black executive leader in America?
Well, first and foremost, I want to say it's ludicrous that the numbers are so low, right? But it's not surprising because if we can barely get a book on a shelf about Black history, why do you think they're going to hire a Black person to run a school system? So, but there's hope for this. This is one of the reasons why I'm working at Howard University. I mean, that was my dream job. It wasn't like it just happened. I've always knew that I was going to work at either Howard or some HBCU, right? Because Howard's always been my number one spot. My dad is a graduate of Howard University. I used to spend a lot of, been to a lot of homecomings growing up, at Howard. And one thing that, I know for sure is we at HBCUs can provide these new Black leaders with the skills that they're going to need to survive and the support networks that they're going to need to survive. So you've got to think, if you got less than 4%, right, of superintendents across this nation who are Black, there is a lack of network for them and support. So how are you going to survive? There's a lack of training to understand that, when you're dealing with Black superintendents, it is a different walk. So you have to ask yourself this question, board members. Are the concerns that people are saying about this Black superintendent, is it coming from a racist or biased space, or is it a reality? And how are you going to take it and react to it? I see our black superintendents time and time again being fired from their jobs for no reason, hearsay, right? No
Correct.
factual information. And it happens all the time. It's like, it's content. Just three superintendents I know of in the past month, right, have lost their jobs over nothing, right? And boards, yes, they did have to cough up a check and pay them, but now there's an impact that's happening for that school system. They got to now go through a process to get somebody else in, which probably won't be a black person, right? So now that those young folks, particularly our black and brown students in those districts, it's a disservice to them. And they're now lacking something, right? But this keeps happening. So we got to make sure we're providing them with the necessary skills, also the support network. And we have to make sure black folks, when we get our seat at the table, that we continue to advocate, right? And I know I have a circle, in the Bourbon Soups, right? We got a little circle of black male superintendent. Now we got a few black females on there too, or black women, excuse me, who are on there as well. But we got to have these spaces where we're able to be vulnerable and have some real conversations around the struggles, that we have. I also think that if we get into these seats, we have to make sure that we are opening the door for other black superintendents. That is to me is imperative, right? A lot of times we get into these spaces, and I'm not speaking about all black leaders, but some black leaders get into the space and they want to be comfortable. They want to maintain their spot. So they end up being the only person in that space. And I tell you this, if I see any black person as a superintendent and there's no other people who look like you on your senior cabinet or running your schools, shame on you. Shame on you. Because it is your responsibility now that you are in that space of authority and you have the power to bring in people of color, you sure enough better be bringing some folks up in there, right? And
Absolutely.
if you don't, shame on you, right? Because you should have somebody who's able to move into your seat, right? And if it's not in your seat, it's some other seat somewhere else. So I've always made an effort to ensure that I was building other black leaders up along the way. And we have to keep doing that. That's how we were able to get, these HBCUs started during Reconstruction, because we were uplifting black people. And then one final thing, America has made black folks, some black folks, because like I said, I don't care, right? But it's made some black folks feel as if they are less than and they're not worthy. We got to remind ourselves that we are worthy. We
Absolutely.
are Americans too, right?
Absolutely.
We this place would not be what it is without the folks who died and worked hard, whose shoulders we stand on, who, went out and petitioned and did all of, the picketing and the silent marching and the nonviolence and all that, on our behalf to get this far. Right. So we have to remember that we do deserve a seat at that table, and we
Absolutely.
should be unapologetically and authentically ourselves when we get and on our way up to getting into that seat at the table.
Well stated, Dr. Hutchins. And I want to be able to expand on, I love how you presented the hope, right? Networking, support, advocating, and bringing others up. And speaking specifically, I want to highlight this too to our Black leaders to underpin your statement. You will probably be identified as a person that's doing reverse racism or reverse racist practice by hiring more Black or brown leaders on your cabinet in your schools as teachers. You're probably going to hear that as a Black leader. Push through, as Dr. Hutchinson said, you have to persevere through that because once you start hiring, right? Once you start hiring more Black or brown leaders, Black or brown teachers, Black teachers, leaders in strategic areas, then you're going to hear the sentiments that, oh, yeah, this is reverse racism. Continue on, because that is actually some things I've been hearing, Dr. Hutchinson, across the country, that when I start hiring, these are from superintendents, Black women, Black men as well. When we start hiring more for Black or Brown, then board members, as well as people and education stakeholders in the organization, start saying this is reverse racism. They're not hiring any white or any Asians. Dr. Hutchison, when I heard
I
that,
heard that too.
is
I
it?
heard it. You know, as soon as you hire somebody black, they're like, oh, you're just only hiring black people. I say, no, I only hire qualified people. How about that? Right. And we had no problem last year when you had a whole senior cabinet that was all white. So, you know, so please.
Listen to my audience out there, take Dr. Hutchison's approach. Don't listen to me. I'm coming with data, analyzing stuff. Doc is like, yes, push through. Right. Excellence and quality. That's what we
That's
need to
right.
look beyond. But Doc, I want to tap into your expertise before we end it, right? Because there's this two phenomenon that I'm seeing where there's that level of interfacing going on. But again, I want you to distinctly provide a definition and a high-level caption around these two phenomenons: culturally responsive pedagogy and culturally responsive practices, right? People have been using them in a linear context, but by definition, they're two different operating pieces of the whole business or education model. Can you explain or can you delineate these two independent phenomenons in their context, culture responsive practices and culture responsive pedagogy, but moreover, how can they be lamented into the cultural threads of a learning organization?
So first and foremost, you know, culturally responsive pedagogy, it refers to like teaching strategies and approaches that recognize the importance, you know, of including students' cultural backgrounds, right? And that's your pedagogy, right? And I think that the difference is culturally responsive practices, it generally refers to like behaviors, attitudes, and policies within an
Thank you.
educational system. Now, the main thing that's important for both, one is cultural practices. When you change policy, you will change practice. And this is why I'm so adamant around dismantling systems, right? Because that's also policies included. With pedagogy, if you're involving instructional materials and instructional practices in your classroom that are designed for a diverse cultural student body, you are now going to create an environment where students feel like you are speaking to me, right? This is culturally relevant to me. You're teaching me the way I need to be taught, right? And it doesn't mean you have to also look like me. People can learn how to to embed culturally relevant pedagogy in their classrooms. And this is how you merge the two together through training. You know, making sure that you have, the teacher training in place and professional learning, that you have a curriculum design, right, that incorporates both, right? And this is how you integrate culturally responsive pedagogy as well as the whole practice piece. Making sure that your assessment practices are in place, because, you know, there are a lot of assessments now that are biased. Right. So how can you ensure that you have equitable and culturally relevant assessments that are in your classrooms? How can you make sure you have policy development, right, that is going to ensure that students are their needs are being met and that your practices are going to be equitable and that there are consequences if they're not, right? So there needs to be policies to make sure that you don't have a choice but to be equitable. How are you going to also get that that community and school kind of like engagement? So having all stakeholders, internal and external, being a part of this process, and then also just the environment and the atmosphere. You know, like, and that's the physical and emotional atmosphere of schools. Like, how can you ensure that you all commit to equity and that you commit to diversity, inclusion, and anti-racism? You know, one thing I know when I was superintendent in Alexandria, and they're still using this now there, is equity and racial equity was a part of the strategic plan. It wasn't a separate tool. It was the lens of how we did our work all of our work, from finances to capital improvement to human capital, to schools and classrooms, right? And that is what organizations are going to have to be able to do to create that equitable and culturally relevant school atmosphere or environment.
I love your definition. And going to my audience first, Dr. Hutchinson, we use this as a professional learning asynchronous tool, andragogy, to be able to support practices, to be able to expand on specific ideologies as well as methodologies to deepen the work, to strengthen the work. To my audience, this is an answer that you want to replay back 2 to 3 times because there are many, many meta themes in there that clearly distinguish between culturally responsive practices and culturally responsive pedagogy. Dr. Hutchinson does an excellent job of providing, I like to say, micro elements to get to that level of defining what culturally responsive pedagogy is. And then also those micro elements that lead up to culturally responsive practices. But the meta theme from that is that culturally responsive practices, behaviors, attitudes, and policies, pedagogy, culturally responsive pedagogy, teaching strategies, ensuring that students have their lived culture or multiple cultures are represented within the curriculum and pedagogy of the learning environments. Excellent, excellent answer. Please, to my audience, play that back again slowly so that now you can be able to impact practices at the leadership level, be able to impact mindsets, attitudes, and culture at the broader organizational level, and then even getting down to, as Dr. Hutchinson eloquently put it, teaching training, professional learning in the context of curriculum design, assessment practices, and policies that we have to examine from a culturally responsive pedagogical lens. Last
That's
question,
right.
Doc. Last. You made it through via. Look, man, I know this is how I know you an alpha man because you lasted the rigor, the research. You lasted through
That's
VFP.
right.
But listen, brother, you're unapologetic. You are authentically unapologetic. So I try to put frames and structures around this question, but usually it don't work. And I know you like to get in good trouble, so take it how it is. But what 3 words? I'm not trying to limit Dr. Gregory C. Hutchinson Jr. to 3 words, but what 3 words do you want today's audience to leave our podcast episode highlighting the importance of culturally responsive leadership, DEIA work, and the AC stage of education?
Yes. So I use this often. I call it VIP, vision, integrity, passion. Those are my 3 words. You got to look beyond today, which is vision. You got to do what you say you're going to do and live up to it. That's integrity. And you got to love what you do, or you won't get back up to come back and do it again, which is passion. So vision, integrity, passion, VIP. Those are my 3 words.
VIP.
That's
Not
right. It ain't very
very,
important
not a
people,
very
right? You
important
might be
person.
important,
You're
but that's not it.
VIP. You're VIP. But when we talk about from the educational context, vision, integrity, and passion,
That's
Dr.
right.
Gregory C. Hutchinson Jr., if any of my audience members want to get in contact with you, want to reach out to you regarding Revolutionary Ed and the work or securing you maybe for a book study, how would they be able to get in contact
Yeah,
with you?
just go right to our website. It's www.revolutionary-ed.com. So revolutionaryed-ed.com. And check us out. Everything you need, the book. You can send me emails through there. You can book me for work, whatever you want to do, right? You can find on the website. And I appreciate the time.
Find him, please, please do. Because, like I said, I've been a fan, I've been a follower for years. And now to be able to work side by side, have access to Doc. Doc, I appreciate your fraternal love for here always. But more importantly, even before that, you were looking out for me as an educational leader going through the ranks. You used to actually see me go through the ranks
That's
to reach
right.
to the superintendent. And when you say, open the door for other Black superintendents, You paved that way for me a while ago. So I always will
Amen.
appreciate you, Doc, for that.
Appreciate it. And I appreciate you. Proud of what you're doing. And thank you just for the opportunity. Keep working, right? Just keep doing it. Like if we don't keep pushing forward unapologetically, then we're doing a disservice to the next generation of black and brown children. So keep it up. I'm proud of
Absolutely.
you. Thank
Thank
you.
you, brother. Hey, on that note, I'm going to end it because that's all I need. I got my video snippet and then cut it out and just play that. But Doc, I appreciate you. And on that note, everyone, onward and upward. Have a great
Word
day.
up for you.